Hello and welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I'm your aptly named host, and I'm glad you're with me. I'd be forced to endure the itching and redness of dermatitis herpetiformis if it came within my ken that you had missed today's show. Offline drives online. Multi-channel engagement is essential, you know that. Drawing from multiple cases, Richard Becker reveals strategies to stand out from your competition for mindshare and have online engagement impact offline outcomes, like giving and volunteering. Richard is president of Target Analytics, and that was recorded at Blackbaud's BBCon conference. And manage those expectations. Maria Semple, our prospect research contributor and the prospect finder, shares expectation management tips. How do you help staff and your board understand what prospect research can and can't do for you? On Tony's Take Two, Throwback Thursdays. We're sponsored by Generosity Series, hosting multi-charity 5K runs and walks. Here's my interview from BBCon last year. This is from last October with Richard Becker. Welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio coverage of BBCon 2013. We're at the Gaylord Convention Center outside Washington, D.C. in National Harbor, Maryland. My guest is Richard Becker. He's president of Target Analytics, part of Blackbaud. And his session topic today is drive offline response with online advertising. Richard Becker, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tony. Appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to have you. Explain, what's the relationship between Target Analytics and Blackbaud, in case I said it wrong?
Yeah, Target Analytics is one of the four business units within Blackbaud, and we use data and analytic-driven insights to create fundraising solutions for our clients, affecting both their direct marketing-driven fundraising as well as their major gift-driven fundraising.
Okay, you probably know George Durney then.
I do know
he's
George.
Director of Sales at Target Analytics, right?
He's fantastic.
He's actually looking for a job. You can tell him I said this. He wants to host a Washington, D.C. morning show, so he may not be your director of sales very much longer. You didn't hear it from me. We're talking about everything multi-channel.
Yes.
Right? Online and offline. Why is a single channel, and let's take the more traditional, offline, no longer satisfactory?
Well, I think the consumer preferences are changing, particularly around the different generations. The traditional target for fundraising are going to be your older individuals, 60, 65 or higher. And traditionally, postal-based direct mail and telemarketing have been great channels to capture those individuals. But as the newer generations come forward, obviously they're in tune with social media, web-based purchasing, and web-based giving. And so there's a new marketing mix that needs to come together to achieve the type of response and conversion rates that direct marketers are looking for.
What if we think our constituency is mostly 60 and over? Or if not mostly, for the proportion that is 60 and over, should we still be relying predominantly on the traditional mail?
It's a great question, and our research and the evidence that we have with the solutions that we bring to bear show that a significant portion of that older demographic, 60 or older, are in fact online and are in fact influenced by email marketing, social media, and online advertising.
Do you have any stats on the penetration of social media among the 60 and over generation?
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly not going to be as high as some of these younger demographics.
Sure. But I do know it's also growing, if you know the growth rate, maybe.
It is absolutely growing, and it's growing double digits year over year.
Okay.
The key here, though, is really to understand the impact on some of these online channels, whether it be online advertising, email, and the like, and social media, on those offline channels. Because here's the important thing. It's not that this older demographic is significantly migrating their donor behavior or their giving to those online channels. They're not. But what we're able to prove with some of the newer solutions and the technology that we have is that the brand impact of putting email in front of them, the brand favorability gained by putting online advertising in front of them, winds up affecting their offline response, whether it be an increased likelihood to open and convert that postal-based direct mail piece or that outbound telemarketing call. So there's a correlation between these online channels and these offline channels. And a big mistake that a lot of the direct marketing entities within nonprofits are prone to make is by operating in silos. Oftentimes, particularly in organizations that are maturing, they'll have an online group and an offline group. And what we're showing our clients is that you really need to bring those groups together, because the impact of online on offline is really the magic.
Okay. Well, let's say a little more about this. Okay. How do we start to integrate the two so that we're getting the impact that that you're talking about?
Sure. We did have a really interesting use case today in our session. We showcased the University of Indiana Environmental Defense Fund and CARE. And the example we used is leveraging online advertising. And I'm going to take a step back, and we'll talk a little bit first about the evolution of online advertising. For most folks, they think of online advertising as, I want to put my ads on a web destination where I think my constituents might be. So, for example, you believe that you want to go over older, wealthier individuals who are likely to give to your organization. So you may think, I should advertise on the New York Times or a site where that type of demographic might be attracted. Mm-hmm. The challenge is, that's really akin to putting up a billboard on the side of the highway in the hopes that those individuals who see your ad also have a philanthropic component to them. Let's face it, not everybody 60 years or older with capacity is necessarily philanthropic. So it's really it's more of a mass advertising play, the legacy way things are done. What most people don't realize is the technology has really evolved considerably over the last 18 months. And so, for example, with online advertising, what we're able to do now is to actually take an input file of individuals based on name and postal address and target them wherever they go online and put online advertising in front of them. So let's think of the use case in the case of the University of Indiana. They wanted to put together a program, a direct mail program, targeting their alumni. And so our value proposition was essentially, look, you know, before that mail piece just winds up showing up at their door, let's reinforce your brand and remind people about their affinity with the University of Indiana.
Yeah.
So before they targeted those roughly 450,000 alumni with that direct mail piece, we took those exact individuals, we found them online, and we served online advertising to them in the months leading up to the direct mail piece showing up at the door. And ultimately, what the results show is, for those individuals that we did put online advertising in front of, it significantly outperformed the group that could have received online advertising and didn't. So we have concrete evidence via metrics that show that you can receive, you know, response rates that are 15, 20, 25% higher when you're reinforcing your brand to the same exact individuals who will ultimately receive that postal-based direct mail piece or telemarketing call.
All right. Now, what do you need to have in place to take advantage of this?
Typically, you know, so in that example, we run campaigns in two ways. Typically, a client wants to market to their existing CRM base. So maybe it's a reactivation campaign. Maybe they're converting event participants to donors, whatever the gist of their campaign is, and we'll take an input file out of their CRM. That's one avenue in which we can run the campaign. The other would be if it's a acquisition campaign, we can create a list of qualified prospects based on the analytics that we've got in Target Analytics and say, these are likely first-time donors to your organization. Let's target them. At this point in time, we're typically looking for clients with a relatively sizable file as an input file for us to target. I believe the smallest file that we've processed in a single campaign would be about 300,000 or so constituents. So it's really oriented towards the mid to large market.
Okay. What is the small and mid-size shop? And recognizing that all the listeners are not Blackboard customers, what do they need to have in place? Or what kind of conversation do they need to have with their database CRM provider to execute what we're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, so typically, we even the smaller clients, we say, look, let's get to a volume that achieves your marketing objective. So even if they have a smaller house file, if they're a smaller client, they have 50,000, 100,000, we'll say, look, we'll take that part of your file, we'll augment it with donor prospects that look like individuals on your file to get to that minimum threshold, and we'll run our campaign against the broader spectrum. There are alternatives. There are clients, obviously, who are going to be on the small side and not be able to afford or produce a file the size of what we want. We might use a different medium then. I'll give you a slightly different example, but but keeping in the spirit of these new emerging channels. We had a client who had a specific cause in the greater New York City area, and they specifically wanted to target based on that geography. The affinity for their cause was in and around Central Park. So rather than using online advertising, we actually used a geographic-based mobile advertising solution that we have that could pinpoint individuals that were using their handheld devices within a specific radius around Central Park, and we were able to target them that way. So there are different alternatives to get at these very specific audiences. It could be, again, the folks in your CRM, a prospect pool, folks in an individual geographic area.
All right, you can cut the data very, very many different ways.
Very finitely, yes.
Okay.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Bonjour, this is Dominique de Kock.
Bonjour, c'est Tamara Zuboff.
Bonjour, c'est Asania Kone.
We are hosting Pardon My French, New York City.
Our guests come from all over the world.
From Mali to New Caledonia, from Paris to Quebec.
French is their common language, yet they all come from different cultures, backgrounds, or countries.
And their common desire is to make New York their home.
Listen to them share their stories.
Join us at Pardon My French, New York City every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m.
Are you stuck in your business or career? Trying to take your business to the next level and it keeps hitting a wall? This is Sam Leibowitz, the Conscious Consultant. I will help you get to the root cause of your abundance issues and help move you forward in your life. Call me now and let's create the future you dream of. 212-721-8183. That's 212-721-8183. The Conscious Consultant, helping conscious people be better business people.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
We're talking about advertising specifically, but we can apply this to other combinations of online and offline.
Absolutely. I mean, the most predominant channel that's been traditionally used is email, and that's been used, I think, with mixed results. The allure of email, particularly around for a small or mid-sized nonprofit, is that there are no limitations to the size of audience you can target. And in many ways, it's a free channel. There's not a whole heck of a lot of cost associated with sending out email. That's the good news.
Yes.
The bad news is it's not an unbelievably, you know, effective channel more often than not because it is free and there's so much competition for mindshare, and your email may or may not break through all the noise that's in that email box. But similar to the online advertising solution that I mentioned, you have to look at email in the same context that it can be supporting other channels. So whether or not you're getting click-through and conversion via email that you're sending, the trick is to understand the impact that email is having when that postal-based direct mail piece shows up or that telemarketing call shows up. And I keep dwelling on that because there was an interesting statistic when we opened up BBCon, and I believe Kevin Mooney stood on the stage, and I believe the quote that he used was that online is growing at four times the rate of offline channels or something to that effect.
Okay.
true as that may be, the reality is 80% of giving is still on these offline channels, and we cannot ignore them. And so the big mantra that we have is you absolutely have to embrace these online channels, and they are viable, and they're going to continue to evolve and become a greater of greater importance to the marketing mix moving forward. But as we sit here today, the real importance of those online channels isn't necessarily the money you're raising directly through them, but the impact that those online channels are having on your legacy channels, mail and telemarketing.
So crucial to have coordination and just really accurate record keeping about who got what when, so we can look at our at each individual organization, see what the degree of correlation is for our constituents.
Absolutely, and that's really what's been missing up until this point is the measurement between these disparate channels. And I think where we started our conversation was too many of our clients will say, well, we looked at the click-through and conversion rates for online advertising and the campaign didn't pay for itself. Or we sent out an email and it didn't raise a whole lot of money. Or we set up a Facebook page and we have, 5 million followers, but we're not getting a lot of donations. You cannot look at those individual channels and evaluate them standalone. You have to be able to evaluate them and their impact across all of your channels. Yeah. And it's really only been within the last 12 to 18 months that we've been able to develop a system and a technology platform that can evaluate these various channels as they work with each other.
The actual outcome on the other in the other channel,
Absolutely.
The more traditional channel.
All right.
It also takes a mindset change to recognize that the Facebook page and the Twitter stream are not the outcome.
Absolutely. We call it a closed loop report. We're closing the loop across all these channels. We're looking at what has occurred amongst them. We're looking at the commonality of who is utilizing them, the sequencing of how they're using, and then the ultimate outcome at us at the consumer or household level. Did they donate? Did they participate? Did they take the action you wanted? And then we're able to correlate that across all the channels and produce meaningful reports that really show the return on your advertising spend, the return on your marketing investment across all those channels. And that's really the big new thing, over the last 12 to 18 months, the ability to quantify that, give a marketer confidence that their marketing mix is either working or not. And it's funny, the online advertising solution that I gave you, we have folks in the audience who said, will this work for me? Or, Richard, you gave an example, but University of Indiana already has strong brand recognition. Mm-hmm. Or, I'm a cancer-related cause, but I know I'm not one of the top three or four. I get why it would work for them, but I'm not sure it would work for me. And, I often jokingly say to folks, I'll tell you one way or the other. I mean, now at least you're in a position that whether this campaign works or not, you have meaningful metrics at the end of the campaign that either prove you're right or you're wrong, that it was going to work or it wasn't going to work. It's no longer guesswork. And, a true direct marketer doesn't like to guess. We like fact-based decisioning.
Another case that you shared was an environmental defense fund. What was the lessons there? What happened there?
Fantastic client and an example of a client who really gets how to integrate their channels. We spent some time today reviewing the specific campaign that they ran with us. And I'll first talk a little bit about something that they do so well. And that's their creative. It starts with the online banner advertising that they created, all consistent, no matter which creative they used out of the portfolio of about 15 different ads that they have. They used a very nice visual of a polar bear, and sometimes the polar bear was doing different things, but it was always a polar bear. The EDF logo displayed prominently, and the call to action, crystal clear, donate here. It was very simple, streamlined, colorful, gets your attention. That's the first thing they did right. The second thing they do right, where the wheels typically fall off for a nonprofit, is they made sure that the direct mail piece correlated 100% to what folks were seeing online. So if you had those online impressions, and we know that getting 7 to 15 online ad impressions per household per month is highly impactful for when that to make the action happen when the direct mail piece comes.
Okay.
So imagine you're getting 7 to 15 of these ad impressions for 30, 60, 90 days before that direct mail piece comes. And every
and
time
you're getting across multiple channels. It could be any site that you go to.
Any site you go to. Yeah. Doesn't matter. Whether you're on Facebook, New York Times, we're going to find you and we're going to put the ad because it's audience-based, not site-based. But EDF is doing such a good job because it's always the same visual and creative that you're seeing. And then so what they do so well is when that direct mail piece comes, the direct mail piece is 100% aligned with what you've been experiencing online.
I feel like I've already seen it.
They're using the same visual.
I'm just able to hold it.
the same messaging, yeah, the same type of ask. And, you know, it's tightly wound up. And what's great is even the landing page, another mistake folks make, is if you do click through the ad, or maybe you see the ad and you think about it, or you get the direct mail piece and you go, you know what, I don't want to write the check. Let me go to the website. The landing page, exactly the same, polar bear, messaging the same, color scheme the same. We have statistics that show that just the slightest change, if they were to move from the polar bear to a seal, or just change any of the color schematics, it can blow the success of the program, you know, completely the wrong way. But EDF was so good about aligning their online and off line channels together and have a true integrated multi-channel marketing strategy. That's why they see such great success rates, and that's why they're one of the leaders in the DM space.
Yeah. What kind of outcomes did they have?
You know, they see what most of our other clients are going to see, you know, 10 to 15% lift in response and conversion rates for those individuals who are part of a multi-channel strategy as opposed to a mono-channel strategy.
Okay. Yeah. And another case you shared was CARE. What are the lessons there?
You know, very similar. They have obviously a very compelling story and visual behind their mission, and they use it quite successfully. Much like EDF, really strong coordination across the offline and online channels, and their success and their strategy really mirrors in many ways what we see with EDF. So another great example.
Okay. We still have a couple minutes left. What more can you tell us about working this multi-channel strategies?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of talk about multi-channel strategy, and really at the end of the day, where what we see is clients need help in, you know, bringing it all together and measuring it. I mentioned earlier that, you know, the biggest challenge I see is that you have the old guard, the folks that are so adept at using, you know, postal-based direct mail to drive results, and they continue to see challenges in the response rates that they're getting and the conversion rates that they're getting. Some of that is, you know, the headwinds of the economy. Some of that are changing demographics. Some of that's, you know, increased competition for, you know, dollars. You know, and then separately, though, you'll see these organizations standing up a separate online group, and they do themselves such a disservice. Yeah. And even when they hire third-party agencies, you'll have, well, we have an offline agency, and then we have an online agency. And so immediately you see how the creative is not going to be linked together. The story that they're telling is going to be different. The channel measure is going to be different. And so where we're seeing success with our clients are those who are having that aha moment, and they're saying, look, this is really one thing, and we need a level of coordination amongst our online and offline marketing. We need measurement across them. We need standardized metrics across them. And I think once they get to that kind of epiphany, that's where it really comes together for them, and they get an optimal outcome.
Okay. I see. Very key and consistent messages are consistency across and the ability to measure. What created this revolution just 12 or 18 months ago? How come we couldn't do it then?
Yeah, you know, I think there's been some advances in technology. You know, going back to the online advertising
solution, side.
You know, the ability to track someone's online activity at a consumer or household level and link that back to their offline activity, it didn't exist 18 or 24 months ago. And our data partner, or our vendor partner for the underlying technology, is a firm called Datalogix, and they've developed the secret sauce, if you will, that enables us to link online and offline activity and to be able to target online advertising at a household level. They've had, you know, it's interesting. If you go back a year and a half ago, there was a big article right before actually Facebook went public that GM had pulled like $40 million or something like that of online advertising budget away from Facebook because they just didn't think they were getting the type of return that they needed. And the reality was they didn't know what type of return because there was no technology in place to measure that. And so Datalogix, now a key partner of not only ours but Facebook, helping them quantify and measure the type of impact those online impressions and those Facebook likes and that Facebook activity has on purchasing a GM car, purchasing consumer packaged goods off the shelf in a Target or a food store. And they're making that linkage, and they're helping us make that linkage for our clients and the interactions they have with their donors.
This is why we're all seeing ads online for sites where we've been, but maybe we didn't make the purchase decision. Or even, I'm not sure I see them as much when I have made the purchase choice, but I know if I go to a resort or a hotel or something, and I'm just browsing around to see what kind of packages they have and what the rooms look like, I'm gonna see that resort in my online advertising.
So we've taken it a step further. So what you described is remarketing, and I would say that remarketing's probably been around, you know, 2 years or so. That's you went to a website, they put a cookie on your device, and now they're following you around and placing advertising within your online experience, attempting you typically to come back and take an action. What's interesting is, you know, and that's phenomenal, but that necessitated you going to the website to begin with, and more than likely it would have been helpful if you registered there and offered your name and address so they could profile you and figure out, you know, what's going to lure you back.
Okay.
The solution I described is, you never had to have gone to the University of Indiana website. You never had to visit the Environmental Defense Fund website. Because we're starting with name and postal address and using this kind of shared cookie pool that we've developed amongst, you know, thousands and thousands of websites out there, we're able to identify you whether you were a former website visitor or not, and we'll always know who you are and be able to link that back to create a rich profile.
There are people who think that you're the devil.
They may. You know, so let me give you the flip side of that, right? People get concerned about privacy. Everything we talk about is obviously DMA compliant, IABA, you know, Internet Advertising Bureau compliant. The reality is, if you're a consumer and if you really thought about it, you're going to get online advertising. You're going to get solicitations via the mail. Wouldn't you rather they be relevant than just random?
I would like to think I would, but there's just something about being followed around the way I described when I had gone to the site and you said they placed a cookie.
Yep.
It just, when that ad pops up on the next site that I've been to, it's just something that feels unseemly about it. I feel a little violated. I feel a little compromised.
We're going to get philosophical here for a moment.
Okay,
but we got a couple minutes.
But we'll keep.
Let me put it this way. There may be a website you enjoy. Maybe it's the New York Times. Maybe it's the Atlanta Journal-Constitution or whatever news site you go to. Maybe there's, you know, social websites you go to. They're free more often than not. You're enjoying the benefit of content that they're providing you, and not paying for it.
Yeah.
But they have to make money, and that money is going to come through contextual and behavioral-based advertising. And so to keep the things that you want free, you're trading off a little bit of your privacy, perhaps, for something like relevant advertising. So I suppose we could move to a model where there's no advertising, or we could move to a model where advertising is totally random, but I think then the internet probably loses some of the no-cost, low-cost enjoyment that you receive, and you'd move to a model where you're going to pay for it one way or the other.
Okay. What do you want to leave us with?
Well, first, let me just say I appreciate the forum. I think it's
been
great.
Thank you, Richard.
You know, this is fantastic. And, you know, the direct marketing space is changing quickly, and people can get intimidated by the wide array of options that are out there. Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, online advertising, so many avenues to touch clients. And I think it's an exciting time when the technology finally catches up and allows us to embrace these channels in a way that can produce a tangible ROI for our clients so that they're not just wasting money. And we know that that's more important for our nonprofit clients than any other vertical out there. So I think it's an exciting time.
Richard Becker is president of Target Analytics at Blackbaud. Richard, thanks so much for being a guest.
Thanks, Tony.
It's been a pleasure.
All right.
Tony Martinetti, nonprofit radio coverage of BBCon 2013. Thanks so much for listening.
My thanks, as always, to everybody at BBCon. The show is so full that it's taken me this long to get to use that Becker interview. But grateful to everybody at Blackbaud and BBCon. Generosity Series, you know them. They host multi-charity, peer-to-peer 5K runs and walks. If you're using summer to plan for your fall fundraising, if you're a small and mid-sized shop that can't generate enough activity to have your own 5K event, think about Generosity Series. They have events coming up in New Jersey, Miami, Atlanta, New York City, Philadelphia, and Toronto. If you think a run walk might make sense for you, talk to Dave Lynn. He's the COO. Tell him you're from Nonprofit Radio. He's at 718-506-9777 or generosityseries.com. We've got Throwback Thursdays on the Facebook page. We're featuring past interviews that I think deserve your attention again. Each Thursday on Facebook. Last week was Andrew Noyes. He's the Facebook director of government relations, at least he was at the time, which is essentially lobbying, but he didn't like to call it that. Yes, Throwback Thursdays. On the Facebook page every Thursday, I remember when I used to have to say facebook.com/Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. But those were the old days, 4 years ago. So check out Throwback Thursday for best guests from our archive. And that is Tony's Take Two for Friday, 1st of August, 30th show of the year. With me now is Maria Semple. You know Maria. She's a prospect finder. She's a trainer and speaker on prospect research. Her website is theprospectfinder.com. And her book is Panning for Gold, Find Your Best Donor Prospects Now! Exclamation mark. She's our doyen of dirt cheap and free. You can follow her on Twitter, at Maria Semple. Maria Semple, welcome back.
Hey there, Tony. How are you?
I'm doing terrifically well. How are you today?
Oh, just fine, thanks.
Excellent, excellent. And thank you again for joining me on the 200th show a couple weeks ago.
Oh, that was fun. But as I said, I do expect to be brought in person okay. to enjoy the party in the studio next time.
Okay. Oh, well, I could have invited you for the 200th. Oh, I didn't. I guess I never think of it because you're always, I know you're just over in Jersey. Oh, I could have had you. All right. There was nothing intentional. It was my oversight. I could have had you over. Sure.
I'm just giving you a hard time.
All right. No, but I feel bad. All right. I'm over it. We want to talk about some expectation setting. You feel like there's a disconnect between what prospect researchers do and what the world thinks they do?
Yeah. So, you know, I thought we'd spend a few minutes talking about that today because I came across a very interesting meme on the internet on actually the APRA Indiana, which is the Association of Professional Researchers for Advancement, on their Facebook page. And this was a meme that was going back a long time ago, back in 2012, I think. And so it kind of had six pictures, and one was a picture that said, what my friends think I do, what my mom thinks I do, what fundraisers think I do, what my kids think I do, what I think I do, and what I really do. And on that final photo, it's a woman sitting in front of the computer, you know, pulling her hair out.
Okay, so this got you thinking.
Right. So it got me thinking about, well, you know, people have a very big misunderstanding about what prospect researchers do or even about what the role of prospect research is in the overall development cycle and, you know, why do we need it? How can we benefit? Some boards are actually afraid of it, right, because they think, well, we shouldn't be, you know, snooping into other people's business and what if they find out?
Yes. And we've talked about this before. When it was in the popular press, I don't know, was it the New York Times or maybe was it the Times that had an article about prospect research, you know, going back a couple of years?
Yeah, I think there was. And, you know, people continue to have this misconception. And even, you know, as you said, there was this article in the Times. So even people who are in the business of gathering information, in fact, when I'm gathering information, I try and think of myself as an investigative reporter, right? Try and be as objective as possible about the data that I come across, not really pass any judgment on it or put any subjective spin on any of the information I'm reporting in any of my profiles.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I do remember us talking about it. And then it came up again. I don't think you and I talked about it, but it came up again sometime last year when there was a woman named Eugette Clark, and she had lived at New York Presbyterian Hospital for, I think it was the last 15 or 20 years of her life or something. She became a resident of the hospital, even though she wasn't ill. And there were questions about what types of information the hospital gathered about her and how they gathered it and whether, you know, meetings and things with her through these decades that she was living there, and that brought it up again too. And I blogged that too. And by the way, I thought New York Presbyterian Hospital didn't do anything that a charity shouldn't be doing with somebody who's living in their facility for 15, 20 years. She was wealthy, and she was a good potential donor.
Right, right. I mean, and then you think about some of the assisted living facilities, you know, extend that a little further, right? They are themselves nonprofit organizations as well. So, yeah, I mean, you have to think about sensitivity of information, yet if somebody is really using your services for that extended period of time and that engaged with your organization, whether they be a consumer or a donor, over a 15, 20-year period of time, certainly there's a lot of cultivation and conversations that happen, and, you know, they could have probably written donor profiles on her without ever sitting in front of a computer.
Yeah, for sure. And that type of information gathering not only does happen, but should happen. I would say that they were negligent if they hadn't. I mean, she lived there all those years. I mean,
yeah.
She's a wealthy woman, and she's living there, benefiting from the work that you provide. You'd be negligent not to be pursuing her as a potential donor. But so, what have you you run up against this problem? Like as a consultant in prospect research, have you run up against this with CEOs, boards? You know, them not really understanding what it is you do.
I think the CEOs have a much better grasp of it because they understand how important it is. They're doing some sort of form of research when they're looking at grants research.
Yeah,
so it's sort of this natural extension that they would be thinking about their individual donor base. But I think it's the boards that are a little bit more uncomfortable with it, depending on the sophistication of the board. They don't really understand public data versus private data, what's accessible. You know, there's an awful lot going on out there right now with people's data being compromised and so forth. So they really don't want to think about, are we compromising somebody's data if we're looking at what their home values are and what their stock holdings are if they're, you know, publicly reporting this information. So they get a little uncomfortable.
How about back on the staff side? And we're going to have some time to talk about the board, not leaving that topic for good, but just back on the staff side, is there a disconnect between what you can do and what, whether it's the CEO or even fundraising staff, think that you can do?
Sometimes there is. Again, it really depends on the sophistication of the organization and how much donor research they've done in the past. So, you know, I'll get a call, for example, from somebody that'll say, we have names of five individuals we need for you to research for us, and we just need to know their net worth. So just from that statement, that tells me a little bit about them and how much they know.
They haven't done that much.
They haven't done that much because I can't find out true net worth.
Right. You can provide lots of measures that we've talked about through the years, from home values to boat values to, you know, to places they've given and things like that and levels they may have given at. You can provide lots of data points, but you can't definitively put a number on net worth.
Right, right. And then, you know, it's an educational process where I let them know about what information I do have access to, what I don't have access to, what's public versus private. And then we have a strong conversation about, well, the number that you come up with, it almost doesn't even matter because you can find lots of articles, for example, on what Bill Gates' net worth is or Warren Buffett, but is he going to give, what is going to get him to want to give to your organization? Are you already engaged in conversations with this individual? How accessible is this individual to you? Have they been giving and at what levels over the years? I think that's a much more important conversation versus a number on a piece of paper.
Yeah, and you know, that makes me think of what I've heard a lot from clients that they want to pursue certain wealthy foundations. And they'll say, well, let's go after, you know, the names you mentioned. Let's go after the Gates Foundation or, you know, others, Ford Foundation, because we know they're so wealthy. But the much more important question first, does that foundation fund what you do? They all have pretty narrow work that they'll fund. And second, exactly what you're saying, do they know who you are? Have you cultivated them at all? It doesn't really matter how much they're worth and how much
right.
they give
and
out every year.
Foundations, in my opinion, are the easiest group to research because they must report all, they're very transparent, they must report everything. They file IRS 990 PFs, which are all publicly available. Most foundations, even some smaller ones today, will have some sort of a minimal website presence, so that even if there has been a shift in focus from what a foundation has been giving to versus what they might be shifting and getting into maybe some new areas of focus, it's all very public and easy to find, versus somebody's individual donor philanthropy is a lot harder to kind of put your finger on. If they're already having certain expectations of, you know, well, we can just go after that foundation because they're wealthy, you can see how the conversation could easily shift to, then let's go after all the wealthy individuals in our community because they're wealthy.
Which is pointless. That's really a waste of time. Without the right cultivation. I mean, if none of them are known, if none of them know who you are, you know, I mean, you can get started, but you can't solicit them right away. That's what I mean. But when I say it's pointless, you can't just ask them for money out of the chute. All right. So I guess if you wanted to tell staff, you sort of said it, but to make it explicit, if you wanted to tell staff, fundraising staff, new to prospect research, what it is you can do, How would you sum it up?
So I would sum it up with what's publicly available and what's not. So let's focus on what's not, because that's the least understood, I think.
Okay.
Bank account information, right? I do not have access to what anybody's bank account data is all about. I have no access to credit reports, right? So I don't know how much credit card debt they're carrying. I don't know how much they're looking at in terms of car loan debt or even house debt. So the entire debt side of the equation, I have no access to that information. Also, if you happen to come across somebody who does own a property in a trust, okay, well, at least that gives you a trigger that, okay, this person has set something up in their estate planning a little bit more sophisticated. They've put their property in a trust, therefore they may have a trust account somewhere else, but that trust account data is not publicly available. So you wouldn't know. You know, you can't go to a trust institution and say, I want to know the value of that trust and what the assets are in it, because that's simply not publicly available.
What else? Anything else?
Spouse and children information. Those are the hard pieces for me of the puzzle that are hard to find, and that's where I think both staff and board who might be closer to that individual could have can glean some information for me in terms of how many children, ages of the children, because that's very important, right, when you're talking about the stage of someone's life, and is this a really good time to solicit them or not, you know. For example, right now I have two kids in college. This is a really bad time to solicit me for a major gift.
Your debt equity ratio is very high.
You would want to know something like that about an individual so that the conversation can then perhaps flow in a different direction.
Okay. We have a couple seconds left. Anything else you want to leave us with before we move to the board?
Yes, stock holdings and salary information, unless they're considered insiders at a public corporation, then I can indeed access data about salary and stock holdings. Otherwise, it's not publicly available information.
And you and I have talked a lot about insiders, what the definition of that is, et cetera. Okay, we're going to go away for a couple of minutes. When we come back, Maria, you and I will keep talking, but we'll move it to the board conversation around your prospect research. So stay with us.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Have you ever considered consulting a roadmap when you feel you need help getting to your destination? When the normal path seems blocked, a little help can come in handy when choosing an alternate route. Your natal chart is a map of your potentials. It addresses relationships, finance, business, health, and above all, creativity. Current planetary cycles can either support or challenge your objectives. I'm Montgomery Taylor. If you would like to explore the help of a private astrological reading, please contact me at Monty@MontyTaylor.com. That's Monty, M-O-N-T-Y, at MontyTaylor.com.
Are you suffering from aches and pains? Has traditional medicine let you down? Are you tired of taking toxic medications? Then come to the Double Diamond Wellness Center and learn how our natural methods can help you to heal. Call us now at 212-721-8183. That's 212-721-8183. Or find us on the web at www.doublediamondwellness.com. We look forward to serving you.
Talking Alternative Radio, 24 hours a day.
If you have big ideas and an average budget, tune into the way above average Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. I do. I'm Jonah Halper from Next Gen Charity.
Welcome back to Big Nonprofit Ideas for the Other 95%. How could you blow your own tagline like that? It's unbelievable. Big Nonprofit Ideas for the Other 95%. We know that. But I want to make sure I'll reinforce the idea. Okay, Maria, let's talk to the board. What would you like to say? Anything different to a board?
I think for the board, my main goal really is to put them at ease about what we find and also how we protect the information that we do find. So wherever that information is stored at your organization, whether it be in a donor database, in hard copy files, whatever the case may be, let them know what you're doing with the information so that they understand how we collect it and how we protect it. I think that that's very important. And also what their role can be in the development cycle, because prospect research is a piece of that. So how they can specifically help to support identifying new prospects and also reviewing current donors that we have in the database that perhaps could be elevated in terms of their giving.
And as you had suggested, filling in gaps where information isn't available or maybe it's very hard to find. For instance, like you mentioned, family information.
That's right. That's often very hard to find, but they might know that person very well. Perhaps they play golf with them, or they know them through the chamber or something like that, so they've had some interaction with them, whereas you as the prospect researcher or the maybe even part-time researcher on a staff, you're playing some other role within the nonprofit fundraising staff, you may not have access to that information because you're not in mingling and interacting with them. So, yeah, they're often really great source of information for familial data.
And I've often said, and I blogged this back, I don't know, a couple of years ago, I remember. In fact, it was around the time when you and I first met online, that I think some of the best prospect research comes from face-to-face conversations with people over lunch or however you do your meetings. I happen to like meetings over meals, but face-to-face conversations, you can learn so much about someone.
You absolutely can, but then the board needs to be educated about how that information needs to filter back to the nonprofit, right? So there's got to be some sort of a trigger or a mechanism or a process or a procedure in place that if they are meeting with somebody or maybe the meeting was a happenstance meeting, maybe it was just a meal and all of a sudden the conversation swayed toward the organization that you're serving on a nonprofit board for, and suddenly the prospect starts asking, you know, lots of trigger questions that would make you believe, gee, you know, they might have an interest in coming down and learning a little bit more about what the organization does. You've got to be able to have them, I guess, train them to have a certain awareness to look for this type of information so that it can be filtered back and that together staff and board can then discuss, well, is this somebody that we should be considering, you know, to make sure they're at a future event or get on our mailing list or whatever the case may be.
What are a couple of those things that board members could be listening for?
Certainly they could be listening for the types of other nonprofits that somebody is already engaged with. So if the conversation turns toward, you know, where they serve on boards, let's say you're a youth-based organization and you hear that this person is, you know, two counties over, but very involved in certain youth-based efforts in their neighborhood. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean they wouldn't necessarily have an interest in knowing what's going on in your neck of the woods. So I think that just understanding where somebody's charitable general family's interests lie is very important. Also, if you hear them talking about corporate boards that they might serve on, that's very important because now that tells us that if that person's serving on a corporate board and if that corporation is public, then we know we can access an awful lot of information about that individual.
Okay.
Because, again, they're reporting it to the SEC, and we can find out a lot about what somebody's stock holdings are, what their compensation is for serving on that corporate board, et cetera.
Even nonprofit boards that they might serve on, because that would lead you to believe that they have a propensity for nonprofit work.
Exactly. So, yeah, finding out what their interests are because of the various boards, both corporate and nonprofit, that they're serving on. You know, it would be kind of interesting to, I think, spend a few minutes at a board meeting showing them how they can use their own LinkedIn accounts to proactively mine them to try and find other people who have similar charitable interests to what they have, for example. Right.
Oh, that's a good board activity.
Yeah, what other board activity they're doing, but also, you know.
I mean, for your board, that's a good activity. A LinkedIn training.
Yeah.
Okay, and yeah. You and I have talked a lot about LinkedIn, and we don't have time to go into it.
Right, but I mean, you could definitely get on in the agenda for a board meeting, and in a 15-minute span of time, if you're just able to get 15 minutes in front of the entire board and do sort of a live LinkedIn, just showing them, if nothing else, showing them that advanced search feature mm-hmm. as to how they can mine it, that would be a very useful time spent on the agenda of the board meeting.
Excellent. Yeah, and I was going to ask. We have this synergy. Well, it's not really a synergy. I don't know. It's a mind connect. Synergy is overused. It's not that. But I was going to ask. You know, how would we get on the agenda of a board meeting as the person responsible for prospect research, whether it's your full time job or just a piece of what you do? That's a great hook. The LinkedIn. You got another tip maybe in just our last minute for getting on a board agenda?
I think if you can proactively identify through sources like GuideStar and foundation directories and so forth who the family foundations are in a community, outline the list of trustees attached to those family foundations, then come to a board meeting, ask to be put on the board agenda for the sole purpose of trying to identify who has connections to any of these trustees so that we can start approaching foundations in our community in a different way where it's a person-to-person entree first as opposed to going in with a blind letter of intent or a proposal.
We have to leave it there. Thank you very much, Maria.
You're very welcome.
She's the Prospect Finder. She's at theprospectfinder.com and at Maria Semple on Twitter. Next week, Gene Takagi is here. We'll continue our 200th show discussion on partnerships and other joint ventures. Gene Takagi, of course, principal of NEO, the Nonprofit and Exempt Organizations Law Group in San Francisco. If you missed any part of today's show, find it on TonyMartinetti.com. If you're a smaller mid-sized shop, remember Generosity Series for multi-charity 5K runs and walks. Dave Lynn, the COO, 718-506-9777 or generositieseries.com. Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff. Sam Leibowitz is on the board as the line producer. The show's social media is by Julia Campbell of J. Campbell Social Marketing. And the remote producer of Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio is John Federico of The New Rules. Our music is by Scott Stein. Be with me next week for Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Go out and be great.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Are you stuck in your business or career? Trying to take your business to the next level and it keeps hitting a wall? This is Sam Leibowitz, the Conscious Consultant. I will help you get to the root cause of your abundance issues and help move you forward in your life. Call me now and let's create the future you dream of. 212-721-8183. That's 212-721-8183. The Conscious Consultant, helping conscious people be better business people.
Hi, I'm Austin Marola.
And I'm Sloan Wainwright.
We're the hosts of the new Thursday morning show, The Music
Power Hour.
At 11 a.m.
We're going to have fun.
And shine the light on all aspects of music.
And its limitless healing possibilities.
We're going to invite artists to share their songs and play live.
We'll be listening and talking about great music from yesterday to today.
So you're invited to share in our musical conversation.
Your ears will be delighted with the sound of music.
And our voices. Join Austin.
And Sloan.
Live Thursdays at 11 a.m. on TalkingAlternative.com.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network at www.TalkingAlternative.com. Now, broadcasting 24 hours a day. Talking Alternative.
Have you ever considered consulting a roadmap when you feel you need help getting to your destination? When the normal path seems blocked, a little help can come in handy when choosing an alternate route. Your natal chart is a map of your potentials. It addresses relationships, finance, business, health, and above all, creativity. Current planetary cycles can either support or challenge your objectives. I'm Montgomery Taylor. If you would like to explore the help of a private astrological reading, please contact me at Monty@MontyTaylor.com. That's Monty, M-O-N-T-Y, at MontyTaylor.com.
Are you suffering from aches and pains? Has traditional medicine let you down? Are you tired of taking toxic medications? Then come to the Double Diamond Wellness Center and learn how our natural methods can help you to heal. Call us now at 212-721-8183. That's 212-721-8183. Or find us on the web at www.doublediamondwellness.com. We look forward to serving you.
TalkingAlternative.com.